Blog Talk Radio.
Welcome to the show, everybody. Movie Geeks United. How you doing?
Well, we're doing pretty good, man. How are you doing, Jamie?
How you doing? Not bad.
Well,
hey.
That's good. I mean, good for you. I mean, you know, you can come on with that kind of very De Niro-esque accent. That's very good.
Did you have a date night this weekend?
Yes, I did have a date night this weekend. I actually liked it. I mean, it's tame, but it's pretty funny, you know?
Yeah.
I mean, it's like, you know,
is it tame in a TV way?
It's a little bit better than that. But you know, it's, look, you're getting two of these big personalities together, and you know, it is, remember, it is directed by Sean Levy, not the critic, but the director of what is it, Night at the Museum,
right.
Films and that sort of thing. So you got, you know what you're getting into when you go into this thing, I hope. And for what it is, it's much better, given everyone involved. I mean, even down to the small performances by, like, James Franco and Mila Kunis, and even those great little cameos by Mark Ruffalo and Kristen Wiig that are hysterical. And the Kristen Wiig thing is just hysterical. But it's actually pretty good. It's, you know, of course, you know, it could be edgier. It could be, you know, more off the wall. But for what it is, it works. It does what it has to do, and I, you know, it's actually, you know, compared to what we were talking about last week with Clash of Titans.
Well, it's man tight, and I'm talking about the race to the box office.
Yeah,
it edged out Clash of the Titans for first place by just a little over $200,000.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Well, I mean, and rightfully, it's a good thing. I mean, you know, we've been reading a lot about Clash of the Titans this week on DevinFerracci.com. Published an article that what could have been the Clash of the Titans movie as to what we saw, and it's not two totally different films. So, you know, it's a shame. Maybe there's a director's cut coming somewhere down the line, but not that it matters. It's, you know, when you're obsessed with the 3D technology and it's an afterthought, and when you're doing, and you're just, I don't know, the film just sounded like it was a mess all around. Forget the 3D technology. It sounds like there's a really great story there that got lost in the editing room.
Meanwhile, How to Train Your Dragon, third place. Tyler Perry's Why Did I Get Married, also in addition to sticks it fourth.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to play with that title. I just don't like that T-O-O. I just don't like the two at the end of a title. I don't know what it is.
Well, you know, I know what you mean. It's, but that did well, didn't it? That has done well, hasn't it? No, seriously, that has done well. I don't know, because he's a very interesting...
All his movies do great, yeah.
No, he's a very interesting individual, and I think as all aspiring filmmakers should study what he's done, because he's bypassed the system and done very well, regardless of what you may think about his films. He's definitely a person to follow and study.
Yeah. When it comes to the box office, he's precious.
Yes, he is. Oh, my God. He went there. All right. Jamie went there.
That's
Let
so
that be
corny.
Record.
So corny. What is this last... Oh, last song is that Miley Cyrus movie that comes in fifth place. You know, that's what they should name all Miley Cyrus movies from now on. That Miley Cyrus movie. And then there's a movie called Letters to God that cracked the top 10.
Yeah, that's one of these independently, I guess, financed religious films that manages to do very well. The faithful go see it, and they have followings. They do very well. Like, you know, that Kirk Cameron firefighter movie that came out a couple of years ago?
Right.
And that did very well, too. So don't rule them out.
No, I think it's a very it's a great big audience that has previously been not tapped into as much as they should have. So that's great. So movies like Letters to God and Passion and The Fire, whatever, with Kirk Cameron and Religious. I mean, yeah.
You put Religious in the same category as all this. Oh, you brave man, you. Oh, my God.
Yeah, yeah. So that's the weekend box office. What's next weekend? What opens in?
Oh, it's Kick-Ass versus Death at the Funeral, but I think it all belongs to Kick. Everyone's seen Kick-Ass except for me, but
yeah.
I mean, no, seriously, since Christmas time, since Harry Knowles at his Austin Film Festival, he showed a rough cut of that, and it just seems like everyone has seen it, whether it be at South by Southwest or wherever. But it's supposed to be really good. It's supposed to be really funny. And very, it is supposed to be what you see in the trailer is what you get.
Right.
Is the impression.
Oh, I understand. It's great.
Yeah. So it should be a lot of fun.
I'm sure it'll be great.
If that's enthusiasm, I don't know what is.
No, I'm sure it's wonderful. Okay, let's get to, later on in the show, man, the things that you guys have to look forward to in tonight's show. Chris will be joining us, I think. And we'll also be premiering a piece of film score from J-Lo's The Backup Plan. I mean, if this isn't the place to be on a Sunday night, I just don't know where else that
I can't wait
be.
To hear the music from The Backup Plan. Remember, Dean's going to call in, too, so.
Oh, okay. So let's get to our first guest. And by the way, if anything's wrong with our phone lines in the chat room, please let us know, and we will do our best to correct it. I'm just so my phone line was off 1 week, and I'm just so paranoid about it happening now. I want people to hear every word I say because it's so valuable. Okay, Indoor is the name of a new thriller starring Judd Nelson and Joey Lauren Adams and Tom Arnold that was shot in my hometown of Lakeland, Florida.
Awesome, man.
I think so too. And it's a great little thriller, and it is premiering. It's actually showing at the Sarasota Film Festival for the next 2 days, Monday and Tuesday, before it goes to the Polk Theater here in town in Lakeland, Florida, and moves on to the Nashville Film Festival the week afterwards. And it'll be making the festival rounds, I'm sure. Here's a great conversation we had with the writer-director of the film, Mr. Joe O'Brien, and it's really a great class on the obstacles that one faces when they're mounting an independent feature film. Here's Joe.
The deceased is a white male named Douglas Macy out of Lake Ridge.
You should know Seth Arnold will be TDY to this investigation.
500,000 acres of swamp.
I would look for someone, Detective, in some capacity from which Mr. Macy was currently seeking approval or respect.
Are you saying that Macy had an accomplice?
Daphne Maiden, 29. She went missing sometime between 10 p.m. the night before last and 8:30 a.m. yesterday morning.
Our Alabama connection got a name and address. James Rollins.
You can't do anything. You can't fix this.
Keep slow, God. The website is some sort of file sharing infrastructure. I mean, you can buy, you can sell, you can trade.
A suspect in pursuit of the victim is at large and may be in the area.
You were standing right here. You saw him make the move. Why didn't you stop him?
If I believe, does my wife live? Do we find Daphne if I believe?
You can be real quiet for me.
So tell me about the film, the origins of the film, the genesis of it, what inspired it.
Like I said, it was a long time coming. The film, the way that it is now, was a process and developed through, 5 years or more. It actually started back in the day when we, started and wanted to do a short film. Just to test the process, we wanted to take the whole model all the way through from, generating a script, writing a script, attracting talent, just the whole process all the way through. And we did that with a short film called Blackwater Elegy, starring John Cullum and
Barry Corbin.
Barry Corbin, yeah. Isn't that retarded? I forgot those guys. But man, it was an overwhelmingly wonderful experience, and did it with a friend of mine, Matt Porter, who is out of Orlando. And through that process, I definitely want to do this again.
Yeah.
We were fortunate enough to get that film picked up by a distribution company called Spiritual Cinema Circle, and it was distributed to, I think, over 60 countries.
Wow.
So we did real well with that.
Wow. So when so that's kind of training ground, the short film, to get your feet wet, and it's a great short film. I've seen it. When you embark on a feature film, this is just a curiosity of mine, is the process just the same as a short film, just amplified by feature length?
I wouldn't say that. I mean, and I've told other people this too, this feature film experience was like doing the most frightening thing you've ever done while someone's behind you whispering, hurry up, the whole time.
Mm-hmm.
So the short film was a luxury in that we had just our folks around us that we trusted, we knew very well, and we could take our time. The location was isolated to a boat, and these older gentlemen were in the boat for the whole, picture.
Mm-hmm.
This feature film was location driven for the budget. I mean, it was pretty intense location driven for the budget we had.
Yeah.
And it was just tough, man. It was tough, but I'm really proud of what happened with it. Being on the other side, I think I can say that now. It has been worthwhile, man. It's been great.
Yeah. So let's get back to the beginnings of it. Did you have an idea already in mind, or were you thinking of a genre and you wanted to marry it to an idea?
Yeah, this is, I've been thinking about this stuff, and especially after listening to some of the shows that you guys have, and I think I boiled it down to the idea of wanting to say or address something.
Mm.
It's not as if I went in and, being a guy who is just overwhelmed with an interest in film for film's sake,
Mm-hmm.
I think that what's driving me is the idea of being able to address something. For instance, in Blackwater Elegy, the short we did, it was all about this idea of living through, most of your life, coming to the end of it and looking back and saying, well, what was that? what did I do with that, those 70 years? And then, this idea for Endure really was built around the concept of the question, when a person has built his life around his own ability to control his life, what happens when that falls apart or breaks down?
Yeah.
I really wanted to tackle that, because I see that tendency in me, just thinking in terms of how I can control this part of my life, this aspect, and so on. And you try doing that for a few years, and you realize, wow, I really don't have that much control. And so the idea was just to put a man or an individual in that particular environment and just explore what happens.
I think that's what makes your film special, part of what makes it special, because, you're dealing with the detective genre. You're dealing with, in a way, the serial killer genre. But what makes your film stands out is that theme that you're talking about, the fact that he's his mission, his work in life, is trying to stop these terrible things from happening, and yet he doesn't have any control over that in his own life. So
yeah.
And how does he relate that to the work that he does, and I thought that was a really fascinating character arc. So yeah. Was that basically the skeleton of what you started working on when you wrote the script?
Yeah, absolutely. And I would say that, you know, making a film that, you know, going through the process, writing, helping in the producing of it and so on, it's not as if I had gathered all these things and then dumped them into a film. You know, it was a self-exploration. And, you know, you start with this concept and then you dive into it hoping to discover something and grow. That's the most attractive aspect of the whole process for me.
Yeah.
It's just to challenge myself to, you know, answer the same questions again.
When you finish the script, or as you reach the end of the writing phase, how did you know when you were done to your satisfaction? What criteria was being met by that final draft?
There are standards. There are conventions of screenwriting that help you determine that. Another very practical way to know when you're done is when someone says, "Oh yeah, we can't shoot that. We can't afford that many pages." So that's another way. And so what, you know, when I thought I was done at 105 or 6 pages, it turned out to be I was done much sooner than that. I had to. That was a very interesting experience having to, you know, the first days, early days of pre-production and have someone say, you know, tiptoe in the office and say, those are really good pages, but we can't shoot them all.
Yeah.
So, that was tough. You just go, you say, wow, I have these parameters. I need to tell this story within, you know, 110 pages or so, 90 to 110. And you set out to do that. And, which is really good. And I've always thought that freedom, real creative, you know, expression, or I guess in a higher concept of freedom, really is learning your boundaries and knowing what you have to work with. And that helps you actually be more creative with what resources you have on hand. So it helped me.
What's always fascinated me about the process that you and other independent filmmakers go through when they're mounting a movie is that obviously you're the writer director of the film, you're the creative brain of the film, and at some point you have to go out and you have to sell the movie for financing or the stage that you're in now, sell it for distribution or something to that effect. And I think those are two opposite halves of the brain that kind of battle each other, because creative types are usually very insulated, kind of they live in themselves.
Right.
And the sales part is a whole different animal.
Yeah. That, you know what's funny, and we had talked about this with my producing partners, Jim Carlton and Rob Trin. We said, oh, man, you know, if we can get through this part, the rest, it should be okay. And then, like, every single step we thought was the toughest step. And that was true for the fundraising part of it. I mean, it was very hard, you know, to go in and just say, look, here's a story we wrote. We would like to make a movie. And these are folks who have not traditionally invested in films. They're real estate people, businessmen who have earned their money the hard way, and it was just hard to do it. But you know, I believed in the film. I believed in what the film was trying to say. So with that behind me, that was the confidence, I guess, that we had to go in and raise the money. I will say that we vetted the script as much as we possibly could. And for instance, I wrote one draft two drafts, three drafts, and then I sent it out for what's called coverage, and then went through probably three phases of that. And then when I started getting positive coverage on it, I said, well, okay, so it might have some legs here. And so then I started sending it to sales companies, companies that review stuff and say, yeah, that looks like it might have something to it. And then once I started getting folks who were interested and started tracking us and wanting to know and calling us and wanting to know what the status was, then I said, okay, well, I think we've got something that somebody would be interested in, at least from a script, you know, point of view. And then, you know, that with our own passion and belief in the project, we went out and, you know, started, you know, graciously asking people for their money.
And how did you, because you're speaking of approaching real estate, people in real estate and various other industries that have really not been approached to invest in a film before, probably. How do you make the movie live in their minds? How do you bring that to life for them?
Yeah, this is great, man, and I'm glad you asked this question. You know, it's funny because I look back on it and I knew ultimately, you know, when I get to teach a film class somewhere, this is what I would say. I would say, look, you cannot, first of all, you cannot make a movie inside your own, I don't even know how to phrase it. Anyway, you need a community to make a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And at some point, you're going to have to get outside yourself and involve other people. And one thing that we've done in the company that I spent a lot of time with and we, you know, did the film under In Focus, we spent a lot of time in the community doing stuff for the community and interacting with these great people of, you know, greater Polk County and, you know, larger community, investing in the lives of other folks. And when it came time to, you know, introduce this idea, they were ready to listen because they knew we were real. We were coming to them with what we thought was valuable, and in the end, they did too.
Yeah.
But, you know, to answer your question directly, we had dialogue with these folks. They knew me as a, you know, a person they could trust, and they believed that, you know, I had a vision for the possibility of what the picture could be, and then I just let them read the script, and there you go.
Yeah. let's talk about the company that you built for this movie, the actors in particular. You've got Judd Nelson and Joey Lauren Adams and Tom Arnold and some great great actors. What was the process of finding those people? What did you see in them that they could bring to the characters? And just tell me whatever you'd like to about that process.
Okay. Well, first of all, it was nothing like I imagined it would be. You know, I imagined, you know, we pick the folks that we want to be in the film. We submit it. They say, great. And, yeah, it just happens magically. It was a process. We had, first of all, there's some aspect of it being market-driven where some, you know, level of actors will carries certain weight in international markets and so on and so forth. So you develop a list of, a wish list of actors that you would like to see in the picture.
Mm-hmm.
And so you just start, you know, you may put them in an order, but that really won't matter because basically what you're doing is trying to find folks on our wish list that A, are available, B, we can afford, and D, will be willing to do the picture. So we sent out, you know, we had our list, and we were very, very fortunate in that, you know, the folks on the list we made were available and willing to do it. Then it was just a matter of who, I say available meaning interested. I should say interested. Then it was a matter of whether or not they were available. And then so that just narrowed it down. And then when we started talking to agents, you know, we got a feel for, you know, who would be right and so on. And then I got to talk to folks. And then from there, it was just a matter of, you know, solidifying the deals, and there you go.
Right.
It was a process, though, man. It was.
And what was the biggest surprise in terms of the production of it, the shooting of it? How did you surprise yourself, or what about the process surprised you the most?
I was very surprised at how literally overwhelming it is. I mean, you know, as a filmmaker, someone, I've been in production for like 30 years doing industrials and television commercials and so on, so I understood the technicalities and so on, but just the amount of decisions and the machine that operated around the director was very overwhelming. You have that, and then you have the dynamic of the actors. I mean, it is an interesting endeavor to you know, work with a cast like we did, and having to, in such a short amount of time, learn the ways that these folks work, and then try to encode direction in a way that would match, say, Judd's direction, and his response to that direction would match Devin's, the way he worked. And so I had to figure out how to and what to say certain things to each of them so that they would match and peak about the same time. So that was a lot.
Yeah.
So
and you found that the members of the cast, they each required something slightly different from you, like a different approach? Or?
Sure. I mean, you know, yeah, absolutely. I mean, that is overwhelming. I'll give you a very good example. Claire Kramer, who played the young woman on the tree, Daphne.
Mm-hmm.
You've seen the film, so you know what a great job she did.
Mm-hmm.
And it was all in her eyes and her face. She was an actress that could, in a split second, get to where she needed to be. She would be goofing off with the crew a few, like, 30 seconds before she had to be handcuffed and up against the tree and crying, and she did it every time. It was that was fascinating and great to watch. Tom Arnold wanted to have specifics. He was supposed to, in this one particular scene, run from one side of the screen to the other, and you know, we were talking about the scene, and he asked me how long have I been running, and so yeah, I came up with some ideas, and he just took off running. I mean, he was just in. Where I think Judd was, he very much intellectualized the process, and some basis for his singing. You know, he wanted to know where he was coming from and where he was going, each scene before and after. So, and that's all just to say there are all these dynamics going on all the time while you're trying to hurry, meet a schedule. And so there you go. I mean, it was fascinating and very, very challenging.
How much of that happens on set, and how much of it were you able to fit in with phone calls or conversations before you started shooting?
Very little. I mean, this is the process. I mean, I walked through with, you know, we got to a location. I walked through the location with the director of photography, which Stephen Campbell, by the way, just amazing, amazing job I think he did with that film.
It's really beautifully photographed.
Oh, my gosh. So,
yeah.
And he was just a lifesaver in many respects, and I'm very grateful to him. At any rate, we would walk through the location. I would say basically what I wanted to happen, and he would say, look, why don't we do this? Why don't we put the camera here? We can capture both those things at the same time. All right.
Mm-hmm.
So I'd say, yeah, that's great, and maybe another pickup over here. So we had a general idea of what we were doing. The actors would come in. Not in makeup or wardrobe. I would walk through what we're looking at, taking the camera here, moving here. We want to hit this mark by your line that says this. And so they would walk through it once, maybe twice, and boom, they were off to makeup and wardrobe. And then next time I saw them, we were rolling, well, we weren't rolling anything, we were recording digits.
Because you shot on the red camera? Is that what you did this project with?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah. We shot two red cameras, and in some circumstances, I think we shot three out in the woods. And basically, that was just to make our days.
Right.
I mean, it's not told anywhere, but we shot the whole film in 16 days.
Mm.
And, well, there you go. That was a lot.
That's great. I mean, you spend 5 years with this idea, and you got to get it done in 16 days. It's unreal, that the whole process of filmmaking.
Yeah, it is. I mean, but see, that's the nature of the industry. I mean, that's just what it is.
Yeah. So tell me, when you look at Endure now, what your feelings are about it. When you take yourself back to the beginnings, when you just had this idea, are you happy? Are you really pleased with it? What do you see now when you look at it?
Yeah, you know, I mean, I'm sure it's like every other kind of creative venture or something, you know, I would call it epic, you know, for me at this juncture anyway. And you look back and think of some of the things you would like to do differently. But I tell you what, man, when I saw the film at the Gasparilla Festival, my first impression was, man, I can't believe how good it looks.
Mm-hmm.
And then I said, wow, I can't believe how good she just did this, you know, this performance. And then there were some great, great moments that I was very pleased with. One being the very last shot. It really came together for me. I won't give it away, but the very last shot with Judd in the hospital there. Are there things that I wish I could have had, you know, done differently? Absolutely. And like I was saying, you know, before the interview, unfortunately, you don't get to practice directing features, you know, in the beginning very a lot. So on the next one, there are some lessons learned for sure. But
So you had your, was that your first film festival screening? This was last week, Gasparilla?
Correct. Yeah, that was the premiere. It sure was. Mm-hmm.
So I always ask this because this particularly interests me. You've lived with it for so long, and when you finally unveil it to a large audience, what do you learn about it? What do you learn about your own film?
That's a great question. I learned that I cared a lot about what happened to this main character. I mean, I wrote it, and I knew what was going to happen. But like I said in the beginning, when you write about it in a manner of self-exploration, it's a different experience. I mean, you literally give birth, or you give it away, you give that life away to the character.
Mm-hmm.
And it rang true to me. You know, like, yeah, it's like I can talk about this idea of, you know, hope in the midst of darkness. I can talk about it. I can, you know, read about it and so on. But when it happened, when I saw how I juxtaposed certain images together, I said, yeah, I really believe that. You know, so it was affirming for me to see it play out on the screen. And I said, yeah, I get that. So,
a lot of times we hear from people, and it's the same thing that you're saying. It's almost like they're seeing it for the first time when they unveil it to an audience, and I just can't imagine how exciting that has to be for a filmmaker.
Yeah, yeah, it really is. It's humbling. It really is. I mean, it feels like you're doing this for yourself, and it's a bizarre feeling, and that, you know, it's the same feeling when you go in to ask for money. Look, I thought up this story and I wrote it down on paper. Now I'd like to go make images. It's a bizarre little exercise. But,
yeah.
You know, if those folks, if someone is getting that same message, or it's coming across, then wow, that was worth it. Yeah, definitely.
So tell me about the rest of the other festival dates and what the plans are for the film from here on.
Yeah, well, the most recent one, the most current one, I guess, coming up is at Polk Theater in Lakeland, Florida. It's April 16th at 8 p.m. They have a website, I guess, where you can get tickets. It's www.polktheater.org.
Yeah.
And then right after that, on the 18th, we're in Nashville for the Nashville Film Festival, and that's April 18th and 19th. And I believe there's tickets still available for both of those. I know Sarasota is sold out, that is.
Yeah.
This coming weekend.
So you have interest in distributors, and you're weighing options from.
Yeah, we do actually. We're fortunate enough to have some interest and a number of inquiries. I believe that we're looking at some ones that we have yet to talk to, so it's hard to determine exactly what's going to happen, but.
Yeah.
I assume that will transpire pretty soon.
Okay, that's Joe O'Brien, writer-director of Endure. You just heard the upcoming festival dates for it. You can find out more about the movie at enduremovie.com. Bring back my co-host here. Hey, Jerry.
Hey, what's going on?
I gotcha. Okay. And Chris, too. Let me bring up your line. Chris.
Hey.
Yo, Chris.
Hey, hey,
hey. Hey, hey.
Sorry, I just saw Why Did I Get Married Too, so I'm a little excited.
Did you really?
No. Hell.
Come on, Jamie. Why would you even believe in me? It's pulling your middle leg, man. Come on.
I know. Does that bother you, Chris, that T-O-O at the end of the title?
Yes. Very much so, yeah. It bothers me.
You lose sleep about it?
No, I mean, it doesn't, like, bother me. I'm not losing sleep about it, but I just don't get it. Maybe it's explained in the movie, but I doubt it. Like, I do think it's just, like, instead of the numeral 2, like, they just decided to be different and use the T-O-O. I'm kind
also, of as well, in addition.
Right.
Yeah.
Yeah, I don't know. I was actually just watching this morning the At the Movies review, which was, you know, mixed. A.O. Scott said, you know, see it, and Michael Phillips said to skip it, but I mean, there's just nothing there that really looks, I mean, it's the same kind of melodrama. I've given those movies a try before, and there's just, the comedy is not funny enough, and the melodrama is too much, so.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay, we posted something on the Facebook page. There's no more room for friends on the Facebook page, by the way. They only allow you 5,000. Yeah.
I can't. I'm your friend, right?
Yeah. Oh,
on
yeah.
Both profiles, I think. Wait, you still have that other profile, though.
You're one of the few that I know. Yeah. No, that's disengage. That's they dropped that profile.
They dropped that profile. Oh my God.
I was adding too many friends. Yeah.
The thing you can do to fix that is to become a you know, you have a page and
a fan page, right?
Did a Jamie DeVal fan page.
God,
right,
if only
right.
I thought. If only I've just put so much work into getting these 5,000. I'm not ready to go on another journey like that.
Well, that's
going to be more.
They do on their own, you know?
Yeah, this could be like more. You could have like thousands and thousands of fans, you know?
Wow. Here's something that we post on the Facebook. Give me your take on the life of David Gale.
How did I know this was going to come up?
It's like, I thought maybe a movie opinion of the day and get some listeners' takes on it. It ranges from comments like, good movie, to it's a disaster, it's an interesting story, just heavy-handed, performances are good, one of my favorite Roger Ebert reviews. Not a fan.
Forgive me. Whenever someone says, like, in a movie is their favorite, like, regardless of the Roger Ebert review, I'm like, come on.
It's a mess, but it's not a boring mess. It's well acted for the most part. Preposterous twist ending. The only reason why I thought of this movie is because it was on one of those Stars channels last night, and it's not a movie that I've ever heard anybody really talk very much about, mm-hmm. certainly not years after the release.
Right.
But we've all seen it, I'm sure, right?
Yeah.
What tells me about it is the idea that people actually thought it was, some people thought it was really offensive.
Well, as I recall, like, I don't remember it being offensive. I didn't see it right when it came out. I was one of the people that waited like a year or two, and I saw it when it first ran on HBO or something like that. And I remember being very uninterested. Like, the trailers just didn't look like, didn't really sell it, and I watched it with little to no expectation. And I remember being pleasantly surprised by it. I seem to remember it being anti-death penalty. Ultimately, like, that's the sort of the message of the movie and the twist that we're speaking about. Sorry, spoiler alert for a movie that came out 8 years ago. But I didn't think it was a disaster. I also didn't think it was the greatest movie. I mean, it was just one of those movies that I thought was decent. Certainly was made better by people like Kevin Spacey and Laura Linney. You know, and that definitely helps. I just didn't find it to be either end of the spectrum, really. You know. Definitely not offensive either. Like, you know, I mean, if you're vehemently pro death penalty, then I guess you would probably find it somewhat offensive. But I'm not vehemently pro death penalty, so. Except for babies, of course.
Of course.
which brings up another interesting thing, which is Alan Parker. Another interesting point about Alan Parker. Where is he in terms of the perception of Alan Parker? I mean, what is your perception of Alan Parker, Jerry?
You know, I mean, it's like The Commitments, Come See the Paradise, The Wall, those sort of things. But I remember watching this movie because I think it was in February. February was a good month of 2003 because January was so bad. January was horrific. It's an all right movie. I remember getting caught up in the thing and I didn't think it was the worst movie ever made. I didn't think it was the best movie. It's a mediocrity.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, like you said, it's a cast that makes you remember anything about it. Kate Winslet being one of the best things about the movie. Spacey, yeah, I mean, I actually kind of like him better in this than I did K-Pax or anything around that time.
Oh, K-Pax. That was on the network the other day, too.
What was it, like Kevin Spacey Mediocre Festival?
You know what? It might have been.
Yeah,
You can just call that the Kevin Spacey Festival, by the way.
Maybe you could. But, you know, it's an interesting film because the themes, the issues that are presented are worthy of discussion. And you do buy his story kind of for the first half of the film. I mean, I wasn't that familiar with any of it, so I was like, all right, this is plausible. And the performances are good. I'm like, you know, Laura Linney and Kate Winslet.
Laura Linney, yeah.
Yeah, you couldn't ask for better performances. But, I it's been 7 years since I've seen the film.
Yeah, and very little is remembered.
Yeah,
right,
I don't remember
right.
that much about it.
Yeah,
I mean,
it is
honest,
one of those.
I'll be honest,
it is
I don't even
those
remember
bad movies.
I don't remember Kate Winslet at all. I couldn't even tell you what part she played. The movie just didn't stick with me like that.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I don't know if it stuck with anyone in that way.
It's one of those movies, but is Alan Parker, where is Alan Parker? I mean, I hate to keep harping on this, but, you know, I've liked many Alan Parker films, but he's not a director I think of very often.
Mm-hmm. No, he's not. And it does seem like he could have gone away several times and sort of came back. I mean, it's a good question. Is he still making movies? I don't know. Has he ever made anything as good as Angel Heart? Probably not, I don't think.
I agree. Angel Heart's good. The Life of David Gale is the last film. He has something called Karim Boy that's in development, but we have The Life of David Gale. Before that, we have Angela's Ashes and Evita. The Road to Wellville, The Commitments, Come See the Paradise, and Mississippi Burning, and Angel Heart, and Birdie, Pink Floyd, The Wall, Shoot the Moon, which is excellent, Fame.
Yeah, it really is. That's just it. He's made a lot of great films early in his career.
Definitely
I think
good movies. Yeah.
I think like the last one that, you know, took national prominence I mean, beyond like the art house crowd writing about something like Come See the Paradise or Angela's Ashes, was Mississippi Burning.
Mm-hmm. Well, The Commitments, though, was the last.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I suppose so.
No, that was a big, big deal. That was the first, you know, you had the van, I mean, the snapper, and then the van came after that. That's part of the Barrytown trilogy. So, you know, it's, but I know what you're saying, though. He was a name there for a while, and then he just sort of disappeared.
And an extraordinary, in his best movies, like an extraordinary visualist, mood artist with his visuals.
Yeah. Well, like bordering on Adrian Lyne territory.
Yes.
But his most famous movie for at least my generation is The Wall. That's what he's
right.
going to be known for is The Wall more than anything else.
Right. I mean, yeah, you're right. And that was – and his style was perfectly suited to that type of musical, that type
mm-hmm.
of –
It is an interesting question, though, because he does sort of fly under the radar. Like, maybe – rattle off those that list of movies that he's made, and it's somewhat impressive.
Mm-hmm.
And
I like Evita.
Flies
actually,
under the radar, doesn't get talked about a lot. You know?
I love Antonio Banderas in Evita.
Oh, Antonio Banderas is the film in Evita. There's no doubt about
Antonio Banderas.
And we should, you know, he rocks the house in that film. Without him, I don't think you have a film.
So I was curious about that. You know. Anyway, I had something else in mind, but I forgot it. It's that kind of night. I'm just not with it tonight. Hoping you guys can help me out.
All right, no. But was there something else? Because it's interesting you bring up The Life of David Gale. I saw that last night, and I saw those comments. And, you know, it's not the worst movie ever made. It's sad that when people say, oh, it's a waste of time. No, I can tell you, like, several wastes of time. A movie that at least engages you, it is flawed. I do think David Gale is a flawed film. But I do remember being thoroughly engaged watching it. Like, I was curious where this was headed. I mean, it's by no means a perfect film, not even a great film, but it is an interesting film.
It's got something to say.
Yeah,
you know?
I mean,
it's not,
you may not agree with
it.
You may not like the execution, but at least I remember being engaged during the film.
Right.
There's another thing about Parker, and this is what I wanted to bring up. In terms of the outrage or the people that were offended by David Gale, there are several movies in Alan Parker's resume that people found offensive, and it kind of strikes me in every case as fake outrage. There are people that were offended by his treatment in the Evita story. There are a lot more people that were offended by Mississippi Burning, led by Pauline Kael's review, which said this is downright offensive. What's offensive about it? I mean, they're
really
offended by the white men coming in and, you know, the white knights coming in and saving the civil rights, you know.
It's annoying that people would say that because, I mean, the truth is there were a lot of white heroes in the civil rights movement. You know, that's the plain truth of it. There was a lot of black heroes. There were a lot of white heroes. Like, why shouldn't there be a movie that portrays a couple of these white heroes?
Mm-hmm.
You know, I mean,
and I think their point was – they probably disagreed with that basis. That
right.
Why are you making a movie about the white heroes when this is when you should be doing the black side of the story?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah,
mm-hmm. Well, I can't. I always hate when people argue with a movie because it's not what they wanted it to be. I mean, I there's
especially
no
historical movie.
Right, mm-hmm. right. You know, I mean, there's a lot of that too. You see it in reviewers, like. Even reputable reviewers, people that I like to read, occasionally they will put out a review where ultimately what they're saying is, this is not the movie I wanted it to be. And I hate that. You know, I mean, that's, you really do have to, I mean, obviously everyone's going to have those kind of expectations about movies sometimes. You know, we're inundated with trailers and media for all these movies before they come out. Oftentimes they're based on subject matter that we're previously familiar with. But you have to leave all that shit at the door. You
mm-hmm.
have to judge the movie based on, you know, not the book you read, not the comic book you read, not the story you heard about in the news 3 years ago. You got to judge it just on the movie, you know, and that happens so much.
Yeah.
It's crazy.
Well, with Mississippi Burning, I go back and watch it for one reason, and that's Gene Hackman. I love
his performance. Also, actually, Willem Dafoe underrated in that movie.
Oh, they're great.
Everyone's very good in that film. And it's amazing. That film has been lost over the decades.
But you could really study Hackman in that. I mean, just as subtle as it gets, you know, and he's observing, and he knows what's what, and he knows how to play it. And, oh, he's great. All right, I think Dean's on the phone, a caller for us. Let's see what he wants to talk about real quick. Dean, are you there?
Yes, I'm here. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah,
I can hear
you
great.
What's up, man?
Hey, how's it going?
Not bad, man.
I'm enjoying the Alan Parker thing, underrated director. Although I think that he pretty much checked out. I'm looking at his – let me look at his thing here. I feel like he pretty much checked out after The Commitments. I mean, if you I didn't really care for Evita, but I kind of checked out on him from Road to Wellville on. I just feel like he hasn't done anything interesting. I didn't even bother seeing Life of David Gale because it just had a sort of vaguely TV movie with big movie stars feel to
it. Right, right.
So I kind of wrote him off kind of a little bit. But that's not to say that I don't think he's a great director. I mean, anybody who could make Bugs Malone, and he's a very musical director. If you look at his thing that you guys haven't really talked about with Bugsy Malone, Fame.
That's an important. I love that film. I used to watch it all the time when it came on television.
I think Bugsy Malone is probably his best movie, if you ask me, really, because it's you know, you might think of the acting as a little strange, and also the fact that all of the kids' singing voices are dubbed by adults.
Mm-hmm.
That adds a kind of strange quality to it. But you know, he won the British Academy Award for Best Screenplay that year for Bugsy Malone, and
right.
It was a tremendous hit overseas, and it's become something of a cult movie, and. I love the score in it, and the art direction is superb, and the costuming, and a lot of funny bits in it. So I think that's.
So,
I also argue for Fame too. I think Fame has become a tremendous. I don't think that people recognize that he's the director of Fame, but. It really shares a lot of stuff with, like, Commitments. You know, he's worked with the same film editor, Jerry Hambling, throughout the years. And I think Jerry Hambling's a big component in how his best films feel. You know, each of his movies has a sort of – all of his best movies have a sort of crunchy editing to them that are really pleasing.
So what other directors do you kind of – have you kind of called off? But have you kind of
Woody Allen
dismissed? What?
I can see that.
With the exception of you know the occasional one that bubbles through, like Vicky Cristina Barcelona.
All right.
I didn't even really care for Match Point because I felt it was a redo of Crimes of the Martin Landau part in Crimes.
Right,
and
right. It is.
Very
I mean,
good.
That, it is that and the one I like even more than that, Cassandra's Dream. They each owe something to Crimes and Misdemeanors.
Yeah, I don't understand why he did that. I mean, what did he think he was achieving?
Well, I mean,
it happens when you make one or two movies every year for the past 35 years.
I've been saying for years that Woody Allen needs to take a break, like
go to Paris
for 2 years and come back and do a really good movie. He needs to do one really great movie again, you know. I mean, he's almost touched on it with, you know, even Vicky Cristina is not a great movie, but, you know, Sweet and Low Down, you know, it's not a great movie. I mean, it's not, you know, Manhattan.
Well,
you know,
no, I mean, you bring up a very good point, Dean. I mean, a lot of people, Woody Allen has lost a lot of fans in the last 20 years. There's no doubt about that. He has a loyal following. But it's dwindled.
I'm getting ready.
I guess there's an argument to be made that screwing your adopted stepdaughter can enhance your creative juices. And I'm not being facetious. I said this is a wedding in 1992. It's no doubt that it's helped him. I think in some regards.
Well, and plus, you know, nobody really talks about that anymore. And you know why? Because it's worked for almost 20 years for them.
You know, it's worked for him in a sense. I mean, come on. I mean, hey, I'm not saying it didn't work. It helped him. Hell, anything.
But if you look at that, I mean, he goes his own way. He does whatever the hell he wants to do. It works for him. That's why he continues to make one or two movies a year.
Yeah, no, he
Well, really,
he
really,
can,
we have. Yeah, go ahead.
No, he, has the greatest deal in the history of movie making. He writes a script, it gets financed, it gets made. Regardless of what you may think about what he makes, this man will always be able to, he's not going to have to go out with a styrofoam cup.
Well, see, I think this is one of his problems, is that he has not I'm not going to try and say that he's not a hard worker, because he is, but I do think that since he's got the sweetheart deal, he doesn't have to work any harder than he wants to, really. I think that the Soon-Yi thing lasted for a long time, and I think that one thing about that is that I think that he's finally actually happy. I think that in
the time, that's happy for Woody Allen is like.
Why don't you ask him if he's happy? Okay.
I think he's relatively happy. He's got a successful marriage, and he's weathered those storms. And I think this is his, this is going to be the marriage till death do us part, whatever. And I think that he has a certain amount of.
I think he's probably content.
Yeah, contentedness to it. And whereas I think before, one of the things that was making his movies so great was that there was a sense of still searching for something. And now I just don't think he's searching at all. So
everything's going great for him. There's only one problem. His young daughter is about to turn 18.
Oh, right.
That's
so
always a problem.
It's not a problem for Woody. This is a problem for Woody.
That's
the first name.
I'll give you another director, and you guys are gonna like. You guys are gonna kill me, but I'm just trying to like stir the pot a little bit. But one director that I'm almost on the verge of writing off, even though I love him and I'm still hoping for great stuff. But I'm not there yet. But I'm sorry. Scorsese needs to go back and go and do like a low budget movie again.
Okay, Chris, I'm going to let you take that. I want you to respond to that.
Well, it's kind of hard to put my thoughts together because if I only look at the last Scorsese movie that was made, then I tend to agree with you. But if I look at the last, four movies that he's made, then I tend to disagree with you. But I think that Scorsese. To be perfectly honest, I tend to agree with you. I'm sorry, I forgot your name.
Dean. Chris.
Dean.
Really,
if it's one side or the other, if it's this is the best time of Scorsese's career or this is the time when Scorsese needs to hit the refresh button, I tend to agree with the refresh button side of it because as much as I like things like The Departed and The Aviator and as much as I think things like Shutter Island and Gangs of New York are commendable, if not perfect, I tend to prefer the littler movies like King of Comedy Raging Bull and After Hours and the stuff that has a little bit more bite to it. And I do think that right in the middle there, The Aviator and The Departed are truly good movies. There's been a little backlash on The Departed since it came out and won the Academy Award. But that movie's going to be around for a while, and the reason is because it's quite good. It's very, very well made. But Gangs of New York is not, and Shutter Island is not, and those two movies will not be around. Those will be looked at in the future as missteps. So I tend to agree with Dean that he does need to go back and make some. I certainly don't agree that I'm about to write him off. No, I definitely
Yes. Let me be more clear. I'm not writing him off, and I haven't really written off the term written off means that there's a significant – I mean, like with Alan Parker, there just seemed to be a significant break with him with, the times. You know, there was just something that was off, Woody Allen and Scorsese will always be of the time, so I wouldn't necessarily write them off. I mean, it's also easy to write off Parker because he hasn't made a movie in 7 years. But with Allen and Scorsese, I wouldn't necessarily write them off. I'm just kind of like definitely in wait and see mode when a movie of theirs comes out now.
It would be nice to see him do something that was a little bit more boiled down, a little bit less grandiose, a little bit less popcorn. It would be those movies After Hours and King of Comedy and Raging Bull. Those are movies that are not for everyone, but I think it's interesting because those movies were released at a time when movies like that could get into a theater and could be seen. Scorsese's a smart enough filmmaker and a smart enough person to know that he simply can't make a movie like that and have it be seen by anyone anymore. I mean, obviously critics will see it, but it will not play to mass audiences. He learned that from things like Kundun and bringing out
Shame. It's a real shame now that he's made a few $100 million hits that he can't just get, and has his name rolling off the tongues of billions of movie lovers everywhere, that now he can't parlay that and do the old switcheroo and give us something that's really low budget and cool like After Hours and say, hey, it's the new Scorsese movie. All you guys that didn't see my stuff when it was making $10 million at the box office, well, now here's the kind of stuff I was doing back then, you know?
Well, Jerry, I mean, you would agree that the independent movement as it became defined, particularly in the 80s, probably has its roots around the time of Sex, Lies, and 89. Right?
Yeah, I mean, it has it in that. It has it in Hal Hartley's films around that time and Jim Jarmusch, I think.
Jarmusch,
Stott,
yeah. I would say
all those
Jarmusch
guys in the mid
really
to late 80s.
What's interesting to me, this is the question I want to ask you, Jerry. What's interesting to me about that is that the time that the independent films broke, Scorsese wasn't making those kinds of films. He went off and he made Cape Fear. He made
Goodfellas, The Cape Fear, and The Age of Innocence at that time when we're talking about the early 90s.
But he did make Bringing Out the Dead towards the end of the decade.
But
Bringing
Out the Dead, all right, Bringing Out the Dead, while it is at its heart an independent film, was a wide release.
Right.
That came out everywhere.
That's the kind of switcheroo I'm kind of talking about, although, you know, of course it didn't really work in the box office, but...
It can't. Dean, it can't. A film can't. You know, this is the problem we have. We're releasing some of these movies at mass consumption that aren't made for mass consumption. Look, let me give you an example. Even though it's not a wide release in terms of Bringing Out the Dead, Greenberg was released at more theaters last weekend. Greenberg is considered a dud. A financial dud.
That's rather unfair, isn't it?
It's unfair.
Yeah, I don't think that's true. I don't think
no,
that's true.
No, it is. Whoa. Greenberg was made for a select group of people. It is the third film in his Monsters trilogy that begins with Squid and the Whale and Margot at the Wedding. Noah Baumbach is probably one of the greatest filmmakers of his generation. His films are not made for all of America. They're made for a small group.
How can you consider one of them a dud, then, if that's the case?
Because I'm considering them a dud from an article in Entertainment Weekly, Chris, which, you know, that great Bible of American cinema. That great Bible of American cinema, which some of our listeners respond to. But it is considered, look, God bless whoever, I think it's Focus Features is the distributor. Am I right on that?
Yes.
No, because I've seen the trailer like 20 times before it came out in the theater. I think it's Focus Features. I know that. But, Greenberg, as far as I'm concerned, is the best film of the year. But it's not mass consumption.
It's a shame.
How many theaters
have
it been released in? I mean, it's only been released in
200 theaters. But
that's
what I'm saying is that my landmark, the landmark in Bethesda, Maryland, which is the height of this kind, which would be the perfect audience for this kind of film, it's at the smallest theater after 1 week of those eight theaters. Now
that's to be expected. The summer movies are ramping up. You've got Dragon movies and you've got Kraken movies.
Well,
and
no,
those
aren't playing there. It's the City Island and the
we're really
the,
lucky.
The Ghost Rider movie and the and that girl with the dragon tattoo on her ass movie.
Well, because it's like an arts theater.
It's an arts theater. But what I'm saying is, because I think Greenberg is on par with After Hours, Bringing Out the Dead, and Raging Bull. I'm just saying that because if you watch Greenberg, it's like, for me, watching Greenberg is like looking in a mirror, but it is that good of a movie, but those kind of movies don't respond well to a lot of people. A lot of people I've talked to hate that movie. They hate Greenberg.
And that's why it's not going to get a release on 3,000 screens.
The guy told me yesterday it was a Ben Stiller movie. He's so funny, but it wasn't a funny movie. I'm like, well, no shit. I mean,
those
it's
are
not
people
a
that
funny
should
movie.
You know, and realistically, It's part of this box office game. Since the years that they've started posting box office results, it becomes a game, and it is an unfair burden to place on a movie like that. Even Ben Stiller was interviewed, and he said, "No, this isn't going to perform like my movies. It's not meant to."
Yeah, absolutely. That's the thing.
Who's
anyone
calling it a dud? How can they come out and call it a dud when it's only in 200 theaters?
Right.
And
right.
I mean,
it's
unfair to like put it up into the, you know,
right.
Oh, it didn't make the top 10. It's a dud. You know, I mean, that's mean.
The top 10. It ain't gonna make the top 50.
Shouldn't. I mean,
It's the kind of movie we respond to, like Permanent Midnight, Flirting with Disaster,
right.
Even Reality Bites. This is
a
movie.
No one called those movies duds.
No.
No.
It's unfortunately
Where do they become classics? They become classics.
Control the studios.
Those movies on VHS, you know,
yeah.
Like those movies become popular when people see them on DVD. Greenberg will be the same way. By the way, I don't remember, you know, there weren't that many people talking about The Squid and the Whale or Margot at the Wedding for that matter.
No, well, to be fair about Margot at the Wedding, Chris, no one talked about it.
Especially Margot at the Wedding because I didn't realize it was such a hated film. Yeah, I despise that movie. I despise it. But I love Squid and the Whale.
No, but let me ask you this. Why do you despise Margot at the Wedding?
I didn't think that any of its characters worked together well. I thought that it looked like it was photographed through a muddy screen.
Dean, can I ask you an honest question?
Sure.
Do you leave the house?
Do I leave the house?
Do you leave the house? Those people are monsters. You mean you don't know a Margo? Everyone knows a Fargo.
No,
Dean. Come on, baby. I read your comments on Facebook. Come on. You're a well-rounded person.
I'm talking about the movie. I'm not talking about whether there are people like that. It's not that.
No, it's hard.
I didn't like the Jack Black character. I didn't feel that it snapped. And obviously a lot of people agree with me, too. But,
that's fine. I mean, for the five people that saw the film... But let me say this. He made two trilogies. He made the Slackers trilogies with Kicking and Screaming, Mr. Jealousy, and Highball. And then he made his Monsters trilogy with Squid and the Whale, Margot at the Wedding, and Greenberg. And
Squid and Greenberg are brilliant, but this one, Margot...
But they're all about the same kind of people.
That's all right, but, you know, they don't all have to work.
No, they don't have to work, but I'm just saying they're all about... If his first three films are about, like, these slackers, his last three films are about these the adults who have become monsters. I mean, he's like Noah Baumbach is essentially like his screenwriting partner, Wes Anderson, but a mean-spirited version of Wes Anderson.
Right.
He has no emo in him.
Yeah, sure. Well, I liked his work in Monsters, Inc. and Monsters Ball. I thought those were great.
Wait, the Monsters Ball, man?
That was the first two
Ball
of his Monsters trilogy.
And Monsters versus Aliens.
Oh, that's
an
awesome movie. I love that movie, man.
Bride of Frankenstein. That was a good monster movie.
That was a good Monsters Ball.
All right. I've never seen a movie about a Monsters Ball before, and I thought it was very eye-opening.
I've seen a couple of Thai movies that way.
All right, Dean. Thank you, buddy, for calling
Dean,
in.
Thank you, man.
Right.
Smoke a joint for me later.
It was a pleasure.
All right. Bye, man.
See you later.
Okay. Hey, you know, one of our guests from the past is going to play Spider-Man in the new reboot.
Logan Lerman?
Logan Lerman is all but 100% confirmed.
So Percy Jackson is going to play Spider-Man.
Yeah. Yeah.
Yeah, that's interesting, though. Technically, I think you could probably admit that he's not Percy Jackson anymore because that movie didn't perform as well as a lot of people thought it was going to. So they're probably not going to be making the rest of those Percy Jackson movies. So he's just going to go ahead and switch over to the Spider-Man franchise.
Which I'm sure they'll make more of.
they'll make plenty more. You know,
who's going to play Mary Jane?
We don't know yet. The Spider-Man
I think it's Courtney Love.
That would be awesome if Courtney Love
played. Logan Lerman and Courtney Love. Go ahead, Chris.
That has to be a hard R.
I'm sorry, Chris. Go ahead.
The Spider-Man thing seems genuine, where audiences aren't stupid. I don't care how good some people claim that these Percy Jackson books are. It's quite obvious that they are trying for the Harry Potter
crowd. Yeah.
It's quite obvious that they are really trying to make this into a Harry Potter thing. They're trying to say, hey, Harry Potter, you like Harry Potter. It's like those, what were they called? Like those colognes that came out back in the 90s. Like, you like CK1?
Let me say this about Percy
Jackson. You're right.
That's exactly what
I
want to
say this about Percy Jackson.
And it doesn't work. People see through it.
They saw through it. Percy Jackson has one thing under his belt. It beat Clash of the Titans to the punch.
I thought Clash of the Titans was a pretty good movie, by the way.
Really? I like the original, the 1981 version. Yeah, this one I was just like, please tell me you got something else. There's a director's cut that explains this better.
Actually, I thought it was a better movie than the
1981. Nah, dude, I'm sorry, dude. I got to tell you, Chris. I got to tell you, it was even for someone, I know you even like Sam Worthington more than me, it turns out. But I got to tell you, dude, I thought it sucked.
Well, I figured you would. I know you're a big fan of the Clash of the Titans, and I am too. I like the
Yeah, but
version.
Here, let me tell you this. It was heartless.
No, disagree. Disagree completely. The first one had nothing to say. The first one was just an action movie, but it had a little bit of soul with the action because there was a lot of heart and soul that just happens to go into that kind of filmmaking.
Mm-hmm.
It happens to go into claymation. I mean, you really have to work at it. So you can feel that when you're watching the movie. No matter how much it looks like claymation, these guys really have to work hard to make this Medusa. You know, I mean, it takes weeks and months to make her just move across the room and and slash her tail at somebody or whatever. So you feel that heart and soul in that first movie, but it didn't really have anything to say. And I thought the new movie was a little bit more interesting. You know, it's not perfect, and neither is the 81 version, by the way. You know, I mean, that's not a great movie. We all love it because we watched it on cable lots, but it's not a great movie. You know,
but what did you say about it? Something about religion in the sequel or in the remake?
Yeah, there's a lot more religious subtext in the new movie that I thought was very, very interesting. Although a little bit unclear towards the end of the movie, they sort of lose track of what they're trying to say. But they raise a lot of questions that I thought were very, very interesting.
So,
I want to
hear about
here.
This religious subtext in the. I know it was released on Easter weekend. Please enlighten me on this.
Well, you didn't feel like there was any religious subtext in
the Well, there's a religious subtext with a polytheistic concern, not a certainly of an Easter concern. There was no monotheistic concern, you know, as far as I was, you know, listening to it.
Oh, that's because these people had multiple gods. They didn't have a monotheistic
They had a better
religion.
Deal.
Regardless of how many gods they had, the movie talked about their growing mistrust in the gods, and I thought that was interesting. I thought it was interesting to see how it's a mainstream movie that's released where the heroes of the movie, their whole impetus for going on this journey is they've had enough of religion. Like, that's kind of the point of the movie.
Well, I thought it was
more
like
kind
Death
of where
Wish.
I'm sorry?
I thought it was more like Death Wish.
Well, there's a little bit of that in there,
no,
too.
I mean,
you can't deny that the impetus of their journey, instead of, in the original movie, Perseus goes on this quest because he loves this girl. Like, that's basically the impetus of his journey. In this movie, the impetus is he is furious at God for what he has done. And I found that really interesting.
That was
interesting,
but I bought it more. I mean, let's put it like this. When he goes to rescue Andromeda is a whole, like, team effort in the first one. And this one, it was just like, oh, I got to rescue Andromeda because on the page in this script it says I have to.
Nah, I disagree.
I think that's
something that a fan of the first movie has to say because they love the first movie.
I know you think that, Chris, but I didn't get any emotion. There was nothing between him and Andromeda. I mean, I'll be very honest. There was nothing. It was like, why are you doing this? You don't care about this girl. You've shown no emotion towards Andromeda
It was to piss off the gods. That was the whole purpose of it. That's what made it so much more interesting than the first movie. It wasn't about this chick who, by the way, I didn't really buy that he gave a crap about her in the first movie either, because Harry Hamlin's a shitty actor, and Sam Worthington is way better. Like, so that's what was
more
interesting.
You didn't feel that way toward Terminator Salvation, baby.
Well, that's true.
Actually, I listened to a show, and we were talking about you both were raving about Terminator Salvation before it came out, and like a new preview came out. And,
it did look so good.
I know. It was a great kind of flashback moment because it was from last year, and you're both like, yeah, it looks like it's going to rock the house, man. It looks like it's going to be every bit.
I bought into that media blitz hook, line, and sinker for that movie. I'll admit that. I will admit it 100%. I thought Terminator Salvation was going to be a really, really decent sequel. And the amazing thing, the only amazing thing that Terminator Salvation did was make Terminator Rise of the Machines look like, you know, a pretty good movie.
Going back to Clash of the Titans, I disagree with you. I got nothing out of it. It looked like a disjointed movie. I mean,
well,
you know, regardless.
Did you see? Let me ask you, Jerry. Did you see it in 3D?
No, I saw it in 2D. I wouldn't. Why would I pay money to see it in 3D? Outsource work to Indians? Why would I even think about doing that?
That is the one. I am giving the movie a good review. I mean, I think people should go see it because I thought it was decent, especially if you're a fan of the first one. I thought that's one of the best things that it did was make me happy. You know, I mean, it's not. I don't have to choose one or the other. You know, I mean, I thought it brought back some really fun moments.
It was boring.
I disagree. I don't think it was boring, dude.
Come on. I mean, I know you want to fight me. I know you want to take me on, but come on, dude.
That's patently untrue, Jerry. In fact, usually you and I agree, and Jamie is the one who we disagree with.
Well, I know Jamie
and now,
would disagree.
It happens to be that two shows in a row you and I have disagreed about something. But I truly enjoyed this movie. I mean, I thought it was a lot of fun.
But I was for the first half of the film, I was truly bored. It just felt like a paint-by-numbers, like that remake of The Time Machine that came out in 2002.
Well, don't get me wrong. I'm not calling this, you know, one of the best movies of the year. I'm calling this a fun movie to go watch, nothing more. And by the way, I do agree with Jerry, go see it in 2D. Do not pay $4 or whatever it is to go see it in 3D. It's not worth it. You know, I mean, in fact, I would go even further. I would say that the 3D does the movie a disservice.
That's what I've heard.
Yeah, it really does. I mean, it's incredibly distracting. The movie is going to look a lot better on Blu-ray. And by the way, if we were doing At the Movies here, I probably wouldn't even say go see it. I would probably say rent it. You know, I mean, this is the kind of movie that when it comes out in Blu-ray, it's going to look really good. It's going to look really sharp. It's a fun hour and a half or whatever it is. And
now, if Greenberg were converted to 3D, I think we'd have something.
I think Greenberg converted to 3D would make people, it would kill the 3D craze.
Yeah,
100%.
You've never seen dysfunction in so many dimensions.
Yeah,
the 3D craze is on its way out anyway.
Do you think 3D is on its way out?
I absolutely do, and this is the reason. This Clash of the Titans and Alice in Wonderland. These are the reasons. In fact, I almost want to say, if you want to go see Clash of the Titans, go see it in 2D. If you want to learn about why 3D, the 3D in Avatar worked so well, then I suggest you go see Clash of the Titans in 3D, because the difference is immediately recognizable. I mean, people don't understand, a lot of people don't, even though I'm screaming it to everyone that I talk to, the difference between a movie that was filmed in 3D and a movie that was, made 3D afterwards with this, you know, Jerry said, with this toying with it afterwards.
Yeah,
it adds nothing. And if they keep doing this with these movies that were not meant to be seen in 3D, then it will go the way of the dodo.
And
it's a
point that
it's coming out.
It's a point that I made too, because people are going. I made it the other week or something. People are going to resent you because you're just using 3D as a ploy to get more money. It's not enhanced experience as much as a ploy to get more money. Katzenberg said as much. Yeah, Katzenberg said as much this week. He said movies like Clash of the Titans will kill 3D.
Yeah.
What else is coming out in 3D?
The problem with that is, and that's the only thing I will say about Clash of the Titans, is people, that's what I mean. The movies, the 3D is doing this movie a disservice, because what they had is a B. They had a movie that's a B. Mm-hmm. And the 3D makes it like a B-, because it kind of takes away from it. It kind of makes you feel like, well, I didn't really get anything. I mean, certainly it's not in the realm of Avatar. I mean, that's what
I don't
Avatar
think anything will be.
So, no, I agree, and we said that, all three of us agreed on that the day after we saw Avatar when we did the show, you know? I mean, I said, we're not going to see 3D done this way for a long time. It's not going to happen, and it hasn't. Like, I don't care how much people like How to Train Your Dragon or whatever, And some people defend Alice in Wonderland, the 3D in that movie.
Well, the 3D in that just seems like an afterthought, so, as
yeah,
well.
No, I agree. It's done.
Because it is.
Let me ask you this.
Let me ask you what it is.
The big confrontation is not for this year, but next year, with Spider-Man and Star Trek. Are those going to be shot in 3D, actually, or is that going to be an afterthought?
I don't know. I think that whether
it's so expensive.
Yeah, it is expensive, but for these big tentpole movies, I think they're willing to risk an extra bunch of money for it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, that's what they want to do for Transformers 3 because they know those movies make a lot of money, but he doesn't have enough time to shoot it on 3D.
You got to have the director, too. I mean, you got to have the director. Before he ever worked in 3D, James Cameron was a visual director.
Mm.
He knows how to orchestrate action scenes. He knows how to orchestrate visual fireworks on screen. And I don't know if we know yet. Oh, yeah, we do know who is directing the Spider-Man movie. It's the guy that made 500 Days of Summer, who, by the way, is a perfectly good director. But is he capable of directing that kind of stuff? You know,
well,
I mean,
it seems like a huge tentpole to put
on
that guy's back.
But, yeah, let me put it to you like this. He is a good director. I have this horrible feeling that we're going to be reading a story in a couple months and he's been let go.
I can't say that I disagree with you, Jerry, because, like, I mean, don't get me wrong. I thought 500 Days of Summer was a decent movie. I wasn't as over the moon about it as so many people were,
right.
And I also didn't think it was a piece of shit like a lot of people claim they thought it was.
Seems to be the later thing is that backlash started before it even came out.
Absolutely. It was too cutesy. It was too aware of itself. I actually thought it was a really decent movie and a step towards reclaiming the romantic comedy.
Right.
But do I see anything in that movie to think that he might be able to direct a Spider-Man movie? Yes, I do. Take on the cast or the task of making this 3D, probably $300 million thing? I don't know, man.
The thing that makes him right for it is what they said when they hired him.
Mm-hmm.
His take on the awkwardness of Peter Parker and his development.
Character.
Yes, the character. What does that have to do with 3D?
I see him getting lost in this, unfortunately, and that's a shame because he's a director that has that showed a lot of promise with that film. And Spider-Man, they've already, with the casting decision that they've made so far, they have said that they want to Twilight this. And they have.
Well, even if he doesn't get lost in the project, what's his name, by the way? Is it Mark Webb?
Mark Webb.
Even if he doesn't get lost in it, even if he does, I think best case scenario, and I hope I'm not underselling the guy because maybe he's more talented than we know, but I feel like best case scenario, he'll turn in like a workman-like, filmed in 3D type movie. I just don't think he has the visual eye that James Cameron, like we said, like it's going to be a long time till we get not only a director who's willing to film a movie in 3D, but a director who's willing to film a movie in 3D that has the kind of eye that James Cameron does for 3D.
And by the way, James Cameron was the one originally attached to Spider-Man before Raimi.
Yeah, long ago.
I mean, I'm sure we would still have been looking at a very successful series of films had Cameron directed it without a doubt. But Cameron's ideas are still in that Raimi film. I mean, his was the idea about the web shooter that grows organically. I mean, he's, as opposed to some kind of gadget or device. And a lot of Cameron's touches are there in the first one. And I thought Sam Raimi, you could say the same thing about Sam Raimi. Sam Raimi came from very kind of over-the-top, delicious, low-budget fare.
Mm-hmm.
But there was something about the sense of adrenaline, about visual excitement that made you feel, he could make a really interesting Spider-Man.
Absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't get that feeling from Mark Webb. It's nothing against Mark Webb, and like I said, it's possible that he does have that kind of feeling.
But he's not.
If we're a court case, we don't have the evidence to prove it.
Here's the thing.
I
don't think Mark Webb really has anything to, unfortunately, do with this. And yeah. I'm probably one of his strongest defenders, but it's not his thing. It's that it's this Twilight thing. They all want to go after this demographic, and I don't.
Oh, why wouldn't you?
Yeah,
why
no, of course
you?
You'd be foolish not to want to go after that demographic. I don't know if Mark Webb is the. We'll see what happens. I mean, I
yeah.
hope that he's
going to be a fascinating thing.
Work again.
It's going to be a fascinating thing.
Yeah.
Here's a movie that's not in 3D, and it has to do with an upcoming show of ours. We got some great guests coming up in the coming weeks, including the screenwriter of You Don't Know Jack, which premieres on HBO on April 24th, and you know why I'm
yeah, we all
really
know.
Excited about that. I'll tell you in a second. And then we've got our three-year anniversary celebration next Sunday. Our three-year anniversary is actually on the 15th, so.
Oh, okay.
I got a week to come up with some clips, and so I made it Sunday. And then later on this month, filmmakers of a new movie called Paper Man with Jeff Daniels and Kevin Pollak will be here, too. Okay.
Kevin Pollak has his own podcast, which, by the way, I love listening to.
Mm-hmm.
Yes, yes. He does, and he's calling in to get some tips from us, so it'll be a very good interview for him. Here's a trailer I wanted to play. Have you guys seen the extended trailer for You Don't Know Jack?
No.
I think I have.
Yeah, it's like a two-minute trailer that HBO just started running, and it's Barry Levinson directing Al Pacino as Jack Kevorkian, and a great cast, Susan Sarandon and Danny Houston and Brenda Vaccaro. I mean, how often do you get a Brenda Vaccaro? And John Goodman.
What you mean?
Right. Here's the trailer that was just made for You Don't Know Jack.
What we're doing here today is groundbreaking. No better word for groundbreaking.
Good morning, everybody. This is the Morning Drive Show. Today it's a special edition. It's the Morning Die Show because of my special guest, Dr. Jack Kevorkian. You might know him better as Dr. Death.
If a person's allowed to die, you do it quickly, painlessly. You don't let them wither away.
What would you charge for this procedure?
You don't charge people for something like this.
Jack, they're threatening to bring you up on murder charges.
Have the gall charge Dr. Kevorkian tonight. Bring it up!
You're not a local quack anymore.
No!
You're America's quack.
America's quack!
I build you up.
What kind of lawyer does that?
I should fire you.
Have you no religion? Have you no God?
He is leading society into an age of enlightenment, you idiot.
Who cares what people think? It's what my patient feels.
And those who say Jack Kevorkian, Dr. Death, is a fanatic?
Zealot. But if it helps everybody else, I can turn fanatic.
Dr. Jack Kevorkian appears at the courthouse locked in an old-fashioned wooden pillory.
Wait, what law am I broken?
Can we all answer the question, sir?
Smart ass.
What's on your mind, Jack?
I'm thinking of the Supreme Court. I'm thinking of going all the way.
I don't know about the law either, but I know when I'm watching a train wreck.
You need people that you can trust. And the only way people trust each other is if they know each other. And nobody knows you.
Nobody.
Jackie Chan killed someone on national television.
Fine, great!
This is such a great idea, Doctor.
These are my decisions to make. Mine alone.
Great Jack Kevorkian.
Man's invincible.
When a law is deemed immoral by you, you must disobey it. You must disobey it.
Yeah, it's going to be an interesting movie, I think. And I'm excited about Barry Levinson actually making something that might be great again.
Well, I'm excited about that. I'm also excited about Pacino taking a part, which I do believe is perfect for him. And I don't think it's perfect for him because he looks like him. And I don't think it's perfect for him because he sounds like him, because actually there's been a lot of talk lately on the Internet about how he sounds nothing like him.
Right, right.
Since the audio of the movie has been, you know, released in clips and trailers and whatnot, what he does have in common with Jack Kevorkian, why he's so perfect, the perfect actor to play it, is because of passion.
Right.
Jack Kevorkian proved time and again that he was passionate about this issue. And even though, you know, he had the courts in his face, he was told, you know, you will be going to prison. He continued to carry on with this endeavor of his.
Right.
And there's no actor in the world who's better at portraying passion than, and I mean passion for an issue, not passion for vagina, than Al Pacino.
Yeah.
He's the most passionate actor around, arguably. So I do think that he's probably more perfect for this part than any part he's played since maybe Merchant of Venice. So it's really kind of...
I'm excited, too. And it's the screenwriter, Adam Mazur, he has one other big screenplay to his credit, Breach. And it's kind of – I'm looking forward to seeing how he portrays Kevorkian because is Kevorkian an enigmatic figure? I mean, some people say murderer. Some people say savior, that kind of character. And him coming off writing Breach, whose lead character was unknowable. And what I love about Breach is it doesn't attempt to explain him, that lead character. It says, yes, he is unknowable. That's the point. He is an unknowable person. You can't go back and say, this is why he did this and this and this. It doesn't try, which I always admired. Okay.
No, that's an excellent point for me.
It's always a good sign. That's always a sign that you said it as well as anyone could have said it.
Okay. Good, because I feel a little insecure about that. There. There was something else that I wanted to bring up, something that I think Ain't It Cool brought it up.
Not the coroner from Wizard of Oz dying.
No, Dixie Carter died today, too.
Yeah, Dixie Carter died, yeah.
She and Hal Holbrook had been married since 84. Hal Holbrook is still with us, though. I can't find it. I'm so sorry, guys. There's not going to be an Arrested Development movie, apparently.
What's his name said, but that's... You know, we've heard otherwise from Ron Howard and Mitchell Hurwitz. I tend to believe Mitchell Hurwitz and Ron Howard before I believe what the hell's his name?
David Cross.
David Cross, yeah.
Yeah.
So I mean, that's an actor, and he's known for being more dry than the fucking Gobi. So pulling our leg there, you know. I mean, like, we've heard very recently from Mitchell Hurwitz and from Ron Howard that the movie is a go, so I tend to sort of believe them as opposed to the very dry comedian. So,
So Jerry, you love Bad Lieutenant, right? Port of Call,
yeah,
New Orleans?
Yeah, I thought Port of Call was a great movie.
And and Chris, you didn't?
I didn't love it. I didn't hate it. I found it completely indecipherable, you know. I mean, ultimately felt the same way I did about it as I would about, you know, a Sanskrit manuscript that you could hand me, you know. I felt ultimately the same way. Like, maybe this is interesting, maybe it's not. I really wouldn't know because I don't understand it at all, you know.
Well, I'm watching it tonight, so I'll probably find myself in the middle of you guys.
Chris, because, you know, according to Werner Herzog, he'd never seen the original. He had no idea what it was. He just took the name. It's like he just hijacked the name.
Right, right. And it's a great name. But I just found it so... And I was so excited about the idea of Nicolas Cage returning to the over-the-top thing, which he never did better than, you know, the movies of, you know, the late 80s and early 90s. You know, stuff like Moonstruck and Wild at Heart and all this kind of stuff, and even Leaving Las Vegas. And I just didn't... I felt like it was. I sort of felt the same way about Bad Lieutenant as I did about Radiohead's "Hail to the Thief." You know, which, like, it felt like Radiohead turned their instruments. They set their instruments to Radiohead and started playing. You know, I mean, like,
right.
it sounded like a Radiohead album, but it didn't feel like a Radiohead album.
That's the same way
I felt about.
That's a good analogy because, you know, it took me a while to get into that CD. I mean, a very long time.
Yeah, that's
that.
Sort of the same way I felt about Bad Lieutenant Port of Call, which is, you know, I mean, it definitely sounded like and looked like a Nicolas Cage, one of those wild Nicolas Cage performances, but it didn't feel genuine, you know, the way that those performances did, like Moonstruck and Wild at Heart and those kind of things. It didn't feel genuine to me. It felt like him turning his instrument to Nicolas Cage and playing.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Well, he's got, I guess, to pay for these all these
outstanding IRS bills and
yeah.
stuff. Yeah,
he's got The Sorcerer's Apprentice. He's got Season of the Witch. There's another National Treasure movie coming. I mean, you see, he's all over the place lately because the bills have got to be paid. And
by the way, all over the place lately? last time I checked, he made The Rock in 1996. By the way, I watched The Rock on TV yesterday because my wife insisted on it. And time has not been kind to The Rock.
I haven't seen it in so long.
That movie is bad. I had not seen it since I saw it in the theater. That is seriously, quite seriously, like in the running for one of the worst movies of all time. Everyone within the sound of my voice, go and rent The Rock and watch it again. One of the worst movies ever
bad,
made.
Wow, man, that's a harsh indictment.
I just want to know if you liked your haircut. All right.
Every line is worse than the previous line. Like, the lines get progressively more cliched and terrible. The movie is, I would say unwatchable, except it's the exact opposite of unwatchable. It's extremely watchable for the exact point that it's so unwatchable.
Right. I get you.
It's so terrible.
Wow, all right, man.
Our last topic. This tells you how diverse our show is when the three of us get together, because we've talked about, Clash of the Titans. We've talked about Alan Parker. We've gone to The Rock and Nicolas Cage. And before we played the score for the backup plan, the new J-Lo movie, to close the show. I wanted to discuss something Chris, you and I were discussing Friday night.
Okay.
Which is a link that I put up on our Facebook of a great intensive article on The Magnificent Ambersons.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
Was Orson Welles' follow-up to Citizen Kane and the beginning of the real downfall of Orson Welles' career in terms of bankability and trust of the studios and that kind of thing. It's an interesting article, but for those out there that are unacquainted, The Magnificent Ambersons is rumored to be every bit as great, if not greater, than Citizen Kane.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that opinion might be out there because it's grandiose and it adds to the legend of the Magnificent Ambersons.
I agree.
Whether or not it's true, no one has seen that original cut except for a couple of people that are still alive.
Mm-hmm.
So I don't know if anyone can necessarily say for sure. And the article's point was, Orson Welles only started saying that when that public conversation began about it. Yes, I was mistreated. I was, because a lot of what happened to Orson Welles happened as a result of his arrogance.
He was his own worst enemy.
He thought they were asking him about a Bartles and James commercial. So.
Sensitivity is always, Chris. I love that. Jerry, this is what I pose to Chris. I mean, for me, and you can comment on it, for me, there is no more kind of tragic real-life figure in American film than Orson Welles.
No, it's you're right. I mean, here's a man who was his own worst enemy. Now, I've seen parts of the parts that have been televised of The Magnificent Ambersons, that cut that's available. And there's no doubt this first is a genius. I do suggest that people, if they are interested in Welles, should watch Richard Linklater's Me and Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm.
There's and even The Cradle Will Rock and even RKO. What was it, the one that Liv Scribner and RKO? What was it?
1138 or something.
Yeah. I mean, they all give these. I mean, he was his own worst enemy. In one sense, he believed all his own hype, and he fed on that. But look at the stuff that came after that: The Third Man, Touch of Evil, The Stranger.
Right.
And these are all magnificent performances.
The thing that makes him tragic is that he was great. He was every bit as great as his arrogance indicated. It was justified. It was just his arrogance made him an enemy.
Mm-hmm.
He thought he was untouchable, and You know what? He was. He was at the very beginning. He was a star of radio, a star of stage. He was in his early 20s, and the studio gave him carte blanche to make Citizen Kane, a movie that they never would have made in that fashion with anyone else. and they gave him Final Cut, and just the idea that they came out with it was,
right.
Was a feat and a testament to what they thought of him.
Mm-hmm.
But then he became too much trouble, I think. And
yeah,
for him
no,
to
I think you're right.
For him to have struggled as much as he did, how many Citizen Kanes could we have had? It is tragic in the sense that it's tragic for people that love movies, because
mm-hmm.
the history of movies could have been so much richer with a working Orson Welles all those years.
Right.
Yeah.
I agree. I mean,
but Chris, your favorite Orson Welles is Touch of Evil.
Without a doubt, by far. The much more enjoyable, you know, like we were saying the other night when we were talking, technically, Citizen Kane is considered to be ahead of its time, and he's, you know, considered to, and not considered, and it's the truth, he really did pioneer these types of filmmaking gimmicks and methods and techniques, but, you know, far ahead of anyone else. No one was even thinking to, you know, make movies in the way that he made that movie.
Now you sound like William Friedkin.
Yeah, really.
Yeah, well,
no one had ever done this before.
Well, no one had, you know, and that's the thing that William, and that's the truth, William Friedkin feels like he is Orson Welles, but he is not, and Orson Welles was Orson Welles. I hate to sound redundant like that, but the truth is that Citizen Kane is simply not that enjoyable to sit through, having, even knowing all of these things, it kind of feels like the sort of movie that you would have to sit through in school, you know, like it was like, gee, we get it, he's fucking rich, and he's lonely, all right, like.
I find that outside of technique, I find the history surrounding that project more interesting than the movie itself,
right.
Because the story
right.
the story
again,
isn't
like, the story
up to
is
the standards
three.
Of the rest of it. Yeah.
Right. The story is number three. The technique is interesting. The story surrounding it with William Randolph Hearst, that's all very interesting. Story is a distant third. You know, I mean, like,
right.
not a great movie as far as just, you know, chilling out, you know, oh, what are we going to watch? What do I want to watch? It's not the kind of movie that people ever sort of put in, other than filmmakers probably, when they just, you know, are sitting around the house and they sort of run their finger down their DVD rack, you know, what am I going to watch? What am I going to watch? What am I going to watch? Citizen Kane is probably not one of the ones that they have
but,
on.
But
know?
The story
like,
is notable. The story is notable for the same reason why the history surrounding it is notable, because
yeah.
of the direct parallels to Hearst. That's the fascination
Absolutely.
With the story.
Yeah, it really
yeah.
is.
But Touch of Evil is the opposite. Touch of Evil has all the filmmaking, you know, I mean, he was able to bring forth so many new filmmaking styles and techniques, and it's an incredibly interesting and fascinating movie. Like, you're really into the characters and the story and everything that's going on. Like, it's a very boiled down, it's very sharp, it's a lot of fun to watch. So that's why it's my favorite.
I think they're all good, and I do like Citizen Kane. I've seen it a couple times, actually, in high school, and we watched it in school, ironically.
Yeah.
I watched it in the journalism class of all classes to watch it. I find it a fascinating film because I do think it says a lot about America in the 30s. It says a lot about America right now. But I do love Touch of Evil just as much, Chris. But I be honest with you, I love Mr. Arcadian a lot, and I watched all three versions a couple of years ago when Criterion released those. But I have to say, if Orson Welles to me has never been better than in The Third Man.
Mm-hmm.
I don't
mm-hmm.
understand the fascination with The Third Man.
Oh,
I'm going to come out of the closet here and say that I find The Third Man to be a boring movie.
Really?
Oh, I love The Third
Man.
Oh,
he is the greatest. He is the Colonel Kurtz of his day. He is the Colonel Kurtz.
And he wanted to be the Colonel Kurtz, literally,
yeah,
before
did.
Citizen
but
Kane, yeah.
Yeah, he is the Colonel Kurtz. He is the greatest before Colonel Kurtz. He is the greatest third act character because his character haunts the whole movie. And when we do meet him, he gives that wonderful speech in the Ferris wheel, which
yeah.
is, as far as I'm concerned, sums up the 20th century. And regardless of what you may believe, that really just sums up the whole entire human existence in that little speech that he gives. He is the Colonel.
I literally
it solves cancer, damn it, that last scene.
I literally said out loud, who gives a fuck, right before that scene.
I know you do. Chris, I know you do, baby. I know you do. That doesn't mean I'm not going to get – I'm not – I mean, but it's just one of those great, great speeches. But he really is. It's the precursor to Kurtz. And when
yeah.
we get to Kurtz –
and he was fascinated by that character, so, you know.
Who isn't fascinated by Kurtz?
Yeah.
Kurtz is
yeah.
like every Hertz represents us all in one sense or another. Whether it's a Joseph Conradian Hertz or a Copelian Hertz, he is the definitive character of fiction. There is no greater character than Kurtz.
Yeah. And Copelian Hertz. I mean, if you're looking for a rental car, I mean, Copla.
Yeah.
Copelian Hertz.
And he can give you a bottle of wine, too, I'm sure. But,
yeah,
it sounds like,
but don't drink and drive.
Obscure, like, it sounds like an obscure genital disease, you know, like Copelian
yes.
Hertz.
Yeah. But,
got it.
No, but I will have
Copelian
to say,
Hertz,
well, let me ask
like
you this, though. Take the critical perspective. Take the academics out of Citizen Kane.
Uh-huh.
Isn't that what
we've never talked about it? If you take all that stuff out of it, you take the history and you take the academics out of it, we never talk about that movie again.
Okay, but wait, now, all right, but let's say you just take the movie that you would watch as a movie, like any movie, like you say, as you pop in or you go to the theater. Doesn't that say a lot about all of us? Doesn't that say about, I don't care who it is, Steve Jobs, Bill Gates, anyone? That's all there.
You know, I do see it. I mean, it does have relevance, but when you're looking at the groundbreaking nature of Citizen Kane, you usually don't hear the story discussed.
Distant third.
Well, it's there, but it's not so much a story. I'm just talking about because I understand what you're saying, Chris. Trust me, you're not the first person to say this, and you won't be the last person to say this. But it is this thing, it is the whole, it does, in our whole celebrity-rich culture and our whole obsession with wealth, it's all there. It's all there in the 30s.
Like you named two perfect examples. You named Bill Gates and Steve Jobs, two guys who happen to know each other. When we talk about great men, you know, in the films we like to romanticize them as being tragic and tortured. Well, you name two guys that are perfectly happy married gentlemen, you know.
No, they're not tragic. They have no rosebud. There's no rosebud
right.
unless there's something
right.
I'm missing.
These are perfectly normal gentlemen, you know, who happen
yeah.
to be you
and
know,
having,
very, very
and
good at what they
that,
do.
And having said that, there is no, you know, I'm not going to go into the 90s or anything, but let's look at the characters that I just named. Let's take a president, W., a mediocrity, the apotheosis of American boomer life, George W. Bush. He's a mediocrity, given everything on the silver platter. You couldn't make a really fascinating movie about him. You tried, but it only works from the prism which you look at it. But we do live in an age where there's mediocrity, where a lot of it. But what I'm saying, it's just an interesting film. It is like what the biopic is sort of takes its it looks at Citizen Kane on that.
The stuff that's interesting about it, the story, even the performances are the story is a distant third.
Here's a fourth.
Like they're not even on the radar.
Yeah.
Here's another way the story resonates, or that character resonates. Citizen Kane was Charles Foster Kane was a great man. Undone by arrogance, greed, bitterness, jealousy, all of those primal urges and sins. And so it can be argued, so was Orson Welles.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I think you can easily look at Citizen Kane as a story of Orson Welles.
Well,
it's
yeah.
Maker.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Because, I mean,
the future, when he made that movie, he was making a movie about the future of his own that hadn't happened yet.
Yeah,
that's what's tragic about it.
Yeah, no, it is. It's kind of like this foreshadowing. And also Touch of Evil, the great line that Marlene Dietrich gives Orson Welles in that movie, you don't have a future.
Right.
That's always
also,
thing with Terry Kelling.
Instead of his deathbed, it was Bogdanovich's couch that he fucking fell asleep on.
Yeah.
Was that before or after the Paul Masson commercials that went wrong?
Oh, the French.
Only after. Although you could argue that he was dead in those commercials.
It's vintage dated.
Well, the other thing I want to bring up, you know, those films, yeah, the film should be about Hearst, and Hearst was a monster. I mean, Hearst was a notorious anti-Semite Nazi sympathizer. But you're right. I do think those films, as we look back at Citizen Kane, it is really about Orson Welles more than Hearst.
Yeah,
I think
yeah.
that's an excellent point, Jamie. Very good point.
Yeah, it's about time. And if there's no better place to end the show than on me making a good point. All right,
so
gentlemen. It's been great fun. Chris, can you join us next week for our 3-year?
Yeah, absolutely.
All right. We'll have lots of clips from the past year, lots of great discussion. It'll just be like one big circle jerk. It'll be a lot of fun. So,
you said it, not me.
Join us next Sunday for our 3-year anniversary, and then we'll be back also the following Wednesday with You Don't Know Jack and Paper Man and great shows from here on out because summer movie season starting, and we're going to have lots of spirited discussion about a lot of these movies coming out over the summer, I'm sure. So thank you both guys for joining tonight.
No
and
problem.
We leave you with a score to the backup plan. Hang on, you got to give me a second. I got to find out who scored the backup plan.
Shit.
I'm typing in IMDb. One moment, please.
You don't even know this.
It was just sent to me.
Well, with that kind of ass, you know, whenever she backs up, there needs to be a plan.
Yeah, really. Talk about urban renewal.
Feel free to talk.
Yeah, well, no, I mean, with the, I think this is a better way to end with this than in the 7 tribute show. It just seemed like really inappropriate.
Yeah, Chris, I was going to end the 7 tribute show with a backup plan.
Yeah, I just didn't think that was right.
Yeah, Jerry knocked some sense into me.
Yeah.
Chris, your thoughts on 7 real quick before we close out with this music.
I'm thankful for the movie. It brought us David Fincher. I think the only problem I have with 7 is that people keep expecting David Fincher to make another movie like that, you know. I mean, they sort of identify him with 7. You know, he sort of made this trilogy of dirty movies with 7, The Game, and Fight Club, and I feel like people want to pigeonhole him into those kind of movies. You know, I think that Fincher is capable of so much more. I'm excited.
And it's great because he's worked against it, yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited about seeing a movie like The Social Network. People were very against it. They wanted to make that body movie. As from the beginning, I said that it's much more interesting to see Fincher, a director like Fincher, go and make Social Network as opposed to seeing him make The Body. I feel like he's covered this territory before. So the thing that I'm happiest about with 7 is that he could have disappeared after he made Alien 3. He could have never gotten another chance. Besides 7 being a great movie, it also gave us Fincher back. You know,
mm-hmm.
gave us the director that went on to make, you know, Fight Club and The Game and Zodiac and Benjamin
mm-hmm.
Button and all the great movies that he's yet to make. So
right.
He's arguably, and not even arguably, like, you know, when you talk about the greatest directors, greatest new directors of our time, you know, the guys that will take over for Scorsese and Eastwood and Spielberg and Coppola, he's always the first on the list, and that says something. You know, 7
is
that guy.
And that's a perfect run-in to our closing score.
I couldn't think of it better.
Thank you, guys. This is Stephen Trask, composer Stephen Trask. Backup plan, I think that one opens next week. Here's his score for it. See you guys next week.
All right. Good night.
All right.
Good night.